The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not. The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform.
And welcome, listeners. Looks like I need to replace that CD. This is your host of the Space Show, David Livingston. Glad to be here, and thank you for tuning in to our Sunday Space Show program, and it's going to be a good one. So make yourself comfortable, and hopefully you'll be able to call in or at least give us some emails. Let me give you that information up front. The toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screener. Please let the phone ring. I'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. And you can also use email, and that is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. That's also our website, thespaceshow.com. So we have a detailed newsletter that will go up later today, and that has all of the information for the coming week, guest bios, and the future events section of the Space Show. And then in addition, if we have to modify our schedule at all, then we do it first and probably only on the website newsletter. So at some point, if you tune in and you're not hearing the program you think you're going to hear, then you check the website newsletter to see if we had to make a change in the program. It'll probably be there. Everything we do is archived, and you can listen right off of our website or easily download the show. There's a Space Show store on our website. Look at the upper part of the website homepage, and it says Space Show Gear. And then, to me, the most important button is the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we're a nonprofit, 501c3 with one O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org. And we're able to bring you these programs because many of you do financially support us. And we thank you very much for that support. Remember, if you're a federal U.S. taxpayer, you do get a deduction for your gift. The same is true for those of you in California paying a California tax, as we are a personal corporation that is excluded from taxation here in California. It's not called a nonprofit. It's a personal benefit corporation, and that's what we are here in California. So if you have any questions about that, visit us on our website, 1-O-N-E-GiantLeapFoundation.org or thespaceshow.com, or please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Everything we do is trademarked and copyrighted. You do have our permission to download our shows and share them with people who you think are interested or should be interested in the program. Very few rules about that, but here they are. They're short and sweet. Don't do written transcripts, even if they're for your own personal use. Please don't do anything commercial with any of the programs. And then finally, please don't edit the programs, even if those edits are for your own personal use or your own private YouTube channel or website. We do podcasts through gigadial.net, and if you want to subscribe to our podcast, the RSS URL for that subscription is on our website and both our email newsletter and our website newsletter. And if you have any problems with that or questions, don't hesitate to email me. And we do thank Andrew for our podcasting with gigadial.net. We're in iTunes and a host of other places on the net, so you shouldn't really have any trouble finding us at all. Do remember also that we are partially sponsored by the Secure World Foundation, and they promote cooperative solutions for space security. And you can get much more information from them on their own website, www.swfound.org. They also are the sponsors of our webinar series. Again, if you have any questions, don't hesitate to email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. I'm very happy to bring back to the show, with updates from his 2013 program, Dr. Michael Schmidt. And Dr. Schmidt is the founder of Solvaris Aerospace LLC, which is based at the Research Innovation Center at Colorado State University. He is on the OMSIS application expert panel for the European Society for Translational Medicine. He is also the chief scientist for Corvette Racing Drivers Science Program and is course director of the postgraduate medicine program, Clinical Genomics Protomics and metabolomics at GWU, George Washington University. Dr. Schmidt is co-chair of the Advanced Pattern Analysis and Countermeasurement Group, which includes investigators from NASA Ames Research Center, JSC. He is co-author of the recent paper, Personalized Medicine in Human Spaceflight, which was the subject of his 2013 program, and that was published in the journal Metabolomics in 2013. The paper, featured by Springer Science Media, highlighted the most influential papers of the year 2013 and 2014. He focuses his work on human performance in extreme conditions, with a focus on upcoming Moon and Mars missions, as well as translating that work into athletic performance and clinical medicine. And he should add in there, pronunciation help for mentally challenged people speaking the English language. Welcome back to the show, Michael. How are you?
Hi, David. It's really great to be with you again. And yeah, some of those words are a mouthful, and they'll probably get peppered in here a little bit with some additional explanation, but I do appreciate you having me back on. Thanks so much.
Well, it's a pleasure, and those words are mild compared to the abstract you sent me that we can talk about later in the show, protecting neural structures and cognitive function during prolonged spaceflight by targeting the brain-derived neurotrophic factor molecular network. So on that one, every other word, I was wondering, boy, I have a PhD, and I don't know any of these words. But as I said, we'll get to that later on. So, personal spaceflight medicine. First of all, for all the new listeners or for the people with short memories from 2013, what do you actually mean by that?
Yeah, so, David, the field of personalized medicine has been discussed quite a bit in Earth medicine, but for spaceflight medicine, it's been a little bit more challenging because, the study of it uses smaller numbers of people. Obviously, there's smaller number of astronauts and so forth. And really what we've argued is that this is the best population of people with whom to use personalized medicine, which basically means, we do careful analysis of their genome, epigenome, proteome, which means the protein molecular network, the metabolome, which is the smaller molecule pool, and then a number of different physiologic measures like, the usual ones, heart rate variability, EEG, EMG, and things like that, as we're studying them in different conditions. But we integrate all of those things, number one, to help identify where the unique susceptibilities are so that they can potentially be corrected while on Earth in preparation for spaceflight. Number two, they can be the targets of intervention or attention while on missions, and then certainly on return to Earth. So it basically means doing a comprehensive molecular profile on the individuals, identifying where their weaknesses are, developing countermeasures that are tailored to that individual. And that's, I think, where the key is. So imagine if we had astronaut A, B, and C, and we don't presently do full genotyping on them. We don't look at their transcriptome or their proteome, etc. But let's imagine that we will do that in the future, which I think we certainly will, and it's actually the near future. Astronaut A, B, and C would each have their own countermeasure package that would be targeted against the unique susceptibilities in their genome and their epigenome, proteome, and on down these various molecular pathways. And this involves many, many hundreds of thousands of molecular markers that we would be using in the research side of it, as well as then eventually the testing and countermeasure development side. So that's the basic frame-up, and I'll let you jump in if you like, David, and ask any further questions.
If we just take the general human factor of microgravity issues, so how different would individuals be from the general way we describe the impact of microgravity on humans? Because, whenever I do a human factor show, they go through the litany of the usual side effects and problems of microgravity. There's always a couple of new ones that are being discovered. But if you were tailoring a package to three or four astronauts to have countermeasures for microgravity, how different from each other would they be?
Yeah, so there's a couple of ways to look at that, David. One is, and I just wanted to also acknowledge my research partner at NASA, JSC, Tom Goodwin, who couldn't be on here with us today, but he's been an integral part of this work. So, for example, we've been part of the artificial gravity working group, which involves a lot of NASA people and private sector people. And one of the things that we've argued there, in fact, we have a paper coming out probably this year on that subject, is when we're studying artificial gravity, how do we know whether, you know, 0.17, 0.38, 0.5, 0.8 G or a full 1 G is necessary? And how do we know who is maybe optimized in one or another condition? So we've really, in general, and I'll get to the individualized part of it in a moment, but we've in general suggested that in artificial gravity work, where we're trying to understand which of those parameters are best, we would use this same omics profiling. And again, I'll mention it just to have it become familiar. That's genomics, where we're really primarily looking at what are called single nucleotide polymorphisms. That basically just means one letter has changed, but it really changes the proteins that are made and the function of an individual. And a classic one that we know is one for hemochromatosis, which is fairly common in the population, causes you to retain too much iron. And in space, too much iron is potentially problematic because it's a high radiation environment. The oxygen saturation on EVAs is high. And so it potentially increases the risk to oxidative stress and DNA damage. So that's just one genetic marker that we would want to know about and see if they're susceptible to different aspects of the space condition. So we're suggesting in general that we look at the omics profile when doing artificial gravity experiments and use that to tailor. In other words, to look at what's the proper G over time that should be applied. And we think that will accelerate the development of understanding the proper G-force to apply on long missions. And I'll use one example. So there's a protein called PGC1-alpha. Now, what that basically does is it facilitates the body making more mitochondria. So if you people with stronger muscles, bigger bones, etc., have more mitochondria. These are the energy generating processes within the cell. So this PGC1-alpha, if you just put somebody under 5 weeks of limb suspension, let's say you use your right arm for 5 weeks and you suspend your left arm for 5 weeks to kind of simulate disuse of space, that one protein, PGC1-alpha, which governs the mitochondria and therefore muscle energy, that one protein falls by about 35% in only 5 weeks. So this is what I mean by understanding when we're studying these things. You know, how do the gene networks influence the susceptibility and how do the molecular profiles inform us about what are the risks and what are the appropriate countermeasures? And so then to get to your question of an individual and how they would manage in space, it really could be quite different. So if you remember last time, David, we talked about the ocular problems that have been developing in astronauts that are staying on the space station for more than 4 months. And while that's not by any means been fully resolved, there are some interesting findings that come out that are showing changes in what's called one-carbon metabolism. You might have heard of some familiar names in medicine and in the media called homocysteine. That's one of the markers that shows when it elevates, it shows there's one-carbon metabolism problem. That goes back to things like vitamin B12 and folic acid and so forth. So there's a very common genotype that affects anywhere from 30 to 85% of the population, depending upon which of the two genes you might have a mutation in. So it's really very common. In one study of about 10,000 people, they showed that 85% had at least one of the two mutations. So that's something that we're looking carefully at. But that appears to play at least some role in these ocular problems developing in space. So that would be one example of a genetic and biochemical change that could put you in that category of having ocular problems or not having ocular problems. So our solution would be find those with that genotype and give them specific analysis and specific countermeasures. The other one I mentioned would be iron and hemochromatosis, because that has been shown to increase oxidative damage and DNA damage in space. So with the increased radiation exposure, that presents its own unique problem. And so to give you an example of two different conditions and how different they might be, take a woman who's about 40 years old and she's flying into space and she may have this hemochromatosis gene mutation. Her blood iron levels might be around 55 or 60. This would be called ferritin. She's losing blood because she's menstruating, or let's say a 35-year-old female. So her levels would be low, but a male who doesn't menstruate, who has this mutation, his iron levels may be, his ferritin levels may be 600. So take that almost a tenfold difference in iron stores, and then potentially being on a long mission with radiation exposure. Now, the countermeasure would be, and this is used in medicine today widely, phlebotomy, which basically draws enough blood to bring the iron levels down. So those are just examples of where we could immediately apply the different countermeasures based on their genetic and widespread molecular analysis.
Would you do these countermeasures on a mission? Like if you were withdrawing blood, what would you do with it?
So on the mission, you know, it depends upon how long on the mission it would be. If you were on a mission to Mars, we suspect that you would not have to do anything like drawing blood on a mission, that it doesn't escalate that rapidly. But you would want to draw blood frequently enough to get it to normal levels before the mission, and then just be attentive to that upon return to Earth. Now, if someone's going to be in space for many years, then I think there would have to be some attention to it while on the mission. But we don't think that in that 1 year's time it's going to rise sufficiently enough to become a mission risk of any kind. But again, to restate, the effects on brain, bone, heart, kidneys, and generally DNA of just that one mutation are pretty significant. And so when you add in the space condition, that accelerates, because this is even significant on Earth, especially in males, and especially when you get into the 50, 60-year-old, let's say, astronaut population. If they have that mutation, that's an age where you'd really start to manifest that.
Is this type of medicine that you're talking about today, is it now the general rule and widely accepted in aerospace medicine, or is it considered to be on the fringe? If I went to a traditional aerospace medicine doctor, would they be up on all of this?
Well, I think they would. You know, they would certainly be familiar with the concept of personalized medicine from the extensive attention it's gotten on Earth-based medicine, and especially in the area of oncology, where they routinely test for certain genotypes of an individual and of a tumor, and then make a drug decision based on that. They would be quite familiar with that, I think, just about all the docs. In terms of applying it to space, you know, I think it is a relatively new concept, but it's a concept that's growing in interest, as well as the use of these omics techniques in space. So we were involved in some of the early on this 12-month mission that, you know, where the twins are, one is flying and one's not. We were involved in some of the early meetings around establishing the use of omics to study that kind of environment. In other words, testing the genome, epigenome, transcriptome, metabolome, proteome, etc., over the course of a year. And testing just one or two subjects is very difficult with omics. But you can do multiple measurements over time, and you can get some very interesting information. So let's go back then to the other part of your question, David, and that is how would the aerospace medicine community look at it as a whole? They would look at some of the things I described earlier, the one carbon metabolism, the hemochromatosis genotype, and things like that. And they would say, oh, yeah, we absolutely should be doing that right away because we do that in earth medicine. Many might say, well, we should study it longer before we do it in space, and I think that's just a philosophical discussion, because you could argue that, well, if this is a problem on Earth, we should really be paying close attention to these on space, in space flight. The other one that we mentioned in our paper, and this I think any physician would recognize in aerospace medicine, would be important to do, and that is the metabolism of drugs. So there's many different, probably about six main pathways that metabolize most of the prescription drugs that you would have on a mission. And it's one category of molecules, our detoxification molecules called cytochrome P450, that have very unique genetic profiles that differ tremendously between different ethnic groups and different individuals. So you might have a black person, a white person, an Asian person who have very different cytochrome P450 profiles just by the difference in ethnicity, but even among individuals, there are different profiles. So you might give a drug to one individual in space that is supposed to metabolize that drug through this pathway called 3A4, but they have a genetic mutation there which causes them to either metabolize it much faster, which means the drug disappears from the blood faster, or much slower, which means the drug remains in circulation longer and may become toxic. So if we knew that going in, we could tailor the drug profile to the individual astronaut so that when they're, you know, now they're 24 hours from Earth. If they're 300 days from Earth and they're taking a drug that elicits an adverse drug reaction because we didn't genotype their drug metabolizing enzyme, that would be a shame, because we have the money, we have the know-how, it's a well-understood, well-respected process. The FDA has approved gene chips for this. So those are the kinds of things where I think aerospace medicine could get behind very quickly.
You have your first email question of the day, and this is from Roger, who's in Salt Lake City. And he said, if you look at space missions over time and then you weed out anything that's longer than, say, going to the moon for a couple of weeks and coming back, are your personal spaceflight medicine issues relevant for anything from orbital tourism to a lunar outpost where maybe you'll be on the moon for a couple of months and then you come back? Or is that so short a time that it doesn't matter?
Yeah, thanks, Roger. I think the simplest answer to that is the shortest, you know, the shortness of some missions may make it so it's a modest effect, but it depends upon what we're talking about. So where it's less clear is in the suborbital category. Let's say we have somebody who's 50 or 60, maybe 70-year-old, who's been cleared to fly, and they have some clotting issues in the blood, or they have some vascular tone issues that might be of a genetic nature. That might be helpful to know in those individuals. So in those shorter ones, there's less risk of sort of a permanent damage as far as we can see. But in the areas of blood clotting and vascular tone, or something like a stroke or a heart attack or a pulmonary embolism, you would definitely want to know certain risks associated with the vascular system and the clotting system. And that's where, you know, that's where we think the focus on short-term commercial flights should probably be right now, you know, until we've learned more and we understand that there might be additional risks. So those are more hemodynamic, let's say. I think in the terms of, we've already shown on the four-month missions, for example, to the space station, these ocular effects. You know, we know there's bone and muscle effects. So, and then when you go to a lunar mission where you expect the radiation doses to be higher, or to a Mars mission where we now have better data on the dosing that would occur on a Mars mission. You know, just in 3 to 4 months on a mission to Mars, you could get a significant amount of, you know, millisieverts in dose, as Hassler's group showed just a couple of years ago. So there we would want to still make sure things like hemochromatosis, that particular genotype with iron status. You know, there's certain ones we'd want to make sure were not present, or at least if they were present in the astronaut or the worker in space, that we would do the appropriate countermeasures for those. So I think part of the answer is we know right now there are certain things we would still attend to, even in the short missions. And then for the, some of the other questions, you know, we've really got to start gathering more data. The one thing that this, these omics profilings help us to do is they help us to get answers faster. So imagine if you're going on a mission or you're studying a certain phenomenon, and in your biochemical analysis, you're measuring 10 or 15 chemical compounds. And you have to guess right in selecting those compounds. In the omics analysis, where you might be measuring thousands, the data will start to direct you to where the areas of change are and where the areas of risk are. And we believe that it can get you much more quickly to looking in the right place.
Okay, listeners, let me make a quick announcement. I know some of you are trying to call the line, and for some reason I cannot answer the line right now. So send in an email instead, and when we take our break in a few minutes, I'll see if I can real quickly figure out the problem. But that line is not answering, and there's nothing I can do about it while I'm still doing the show. So send in an email instead, make it succinct and short and to the point, and I'll try to fix it when we take a break in about 12 to 15 minutes. Sorry about that, listener. Somebody's calling wildly, so and they're not paying attention to what I'm saying yet, but we will see. Is NASA fully behind what you're doing? Is in ESA, and what happens with the Chinese and the Russian space program, or do you have any information with them?
Well, so you know, NASA, since the paper was published in electronically in June of 2013, and then December on the hard copy in 2013, there's really been a change in the culture within and outside NASA that have started to embrace these concepts of using omics in the development of personalized medicine approaches. There, of course, as you might expect, there's going to be different spectrums of individuals. Some say we're ready to go with some of it now. Some will say it's going to take a lot more data. So I think, I mean, we're pretty pleased with the change that has begun to happen. NASA's gotten much more interested. We actually have a call in the morning with some ESA people who are doing an omics study oriented around this same concept. And so I would say that's growing significantly as we get a better handle on this sort of complex world of omics, and then how do we understand the pathways that it leads to, and then how do we get to the actual countermeasure that we can agree upon that's going to work. So I would say the concept is getting a lot more attention and interest, and we all understand we need a lot more work, but as more people get involved in this and interested, I think we can spread that workload out and get to answers quickly. And as you know, potentially going to Mars in the 2022 or 2030, let's say, that's a quite a short amount of time to answer some of the tough questions that still have to be answered. And we think omics will help do that, and we think that eventually some of the personalized medicine concepts will be part of that, those missions.
What about Russia and China?
We haven't seen as much activity in China, at least not in the English literature, but they've been looking in the personalized medicine area. And I think Russia, I'll have to just say that I don't know what Russia's doing in this particular space right now, at least not as it pertains to the English literature. But they're certainly familiar with these concepts. And Russia, in some areas of human factors, have been pretty ambitious.
Anything about China at all, or just a wild unknown?
Yeah, and that I don't know specifically about what China is doing in this particular space of omics. In the area of personalized medicine, you know, there's some work going on there.
I really love it when people follow instructions. So, listeners, I'm going to make the announcement again. I cannot answer the toll-free line. There's something wrong with it. Please send in an email. You can call it until the cows come home, and I can't answer it. So whoever is doing it, you need to listen. Send in an email, make it short and sweet, and I will try to fix it when we take our break in a few minutes. But if you keep trying to call, I can see it's ringing, but I cannot answer it. So pay attention, please. There ought to be a test. Do astronauts get a test on can they follow instructions?
I think they get quite a few of those.
What brought you to having an interest in this field?
You know, I'll go to one fairly unusual experience that goes back to undergrad, but I think it makes a statement quite relevant to all of us who are looking at this. So back at the University of Minnesota, I was supposed to attend an evening lecture on neuroscience, and it was in the middle of a horrible snowstorm when I got to the lecture hall, all covered in white. They had canceled it because the speaker couldn't make it. So they had someone there from the University of Alabama speaking about diatoms, which had nothing to do with what I was interested in, but I didn't want to jump back into the storm, so I thought, I'll stay there. And he showed slide after slide, and if you know what diatoms are, they're single-celled organisms. You've probably heard of diatomaceous earth, but they're like a silica skeleton, and they have and calcite skeleton, and they have some really beautiful and elegant shapes and skeletal patterns and kind of a ray-shaped look to them. So this speaker goes on one slide after another, showing us these quite different-looking organisms, different array patterns, different colors, and things like that. Then he goes back, and he said, so what I'm going to show you now is the same organisms. Here's one in a selenium-enriched environment, a selenium-deficient environment. Here's one in a magnesium-enriched environment, a magnesium-deficient environment, and so on. So we went slide by slide by slide. Basically, they were all the same organism, but they looked completely different in terms of their architecture and in terms of their color. And it struck me because I was in the middle of studying genetics at the time, it struck me that that was gene expression at work, that these trace elements were so dramatically changing gene expression that these organisms didn't look like the same species. They looked entirely different. And, you know, way back then I thought, so what we do from an environmental perspective, whether that's nutrition or other exposures, is really shaping how the genome acts. You know, and that's really, for me, where it came into play. And then as we started doing more metabolic profiling of humans in medicine, humans in extreme conditions, human athletes and things like that, you know, we saw very clearly broad molecular changes, influence of genetics, and that a lot of this was modifiable with different countermeasures. So we have seen it at work in the clinical world, in the high-performance world, and we're quite convinced that there's no reason that it shouldn't be deployable into the space medicine world.
Here I'll read an email that I'm getting from George's in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And he said, given what you said, is there any reason for the medical personnel of the commercial spaceflight companies to be paying attention to this? I'm thinking of the suborbital companies because that seems to be all there is right now. Is it relevant at all or way premature for them to be involved in this?
Well, I think the commercial spaceflight companies, and you know, we've talked to some of them, I think they have a need to understand this from two levels. One is from their pilot level. So, for example, what is the occupational risk to a pilot who's going to fly up 6 times a week, 12 times a week, whatever the rate is, 30 times a month? You know, that one trip isn't a lot of radiation exposure, for example, but is there an exposure over 1 or 2 or 5 years that has a cumulative effect and could affect the pilots and any of the engineers or the space scientists that would be flying repeatedly to run experiments? I think that's the first area that the commercial space flight industry, at least the suborbital, would want to look. For example, we presented an abstract at one of the suborbital conferences a couple of years ago looking at this radiation question and saying, you know, there's evidence that people are susceptible to space radiation before going into space. And there are some countermeasures that we believe one can take at the molecular level before going into space that could minimize a given exposure. We don't think the radiation is such an issue for the commercial consumer who's just going to fly once. We think for pilots it is. I think the issue with the consumers who are flying, you know, is going to have to do with the various medical conditions they may fly with and what we need to be looking for. And that kind of goes back to what I mentioned earlier with cerebrovascular, cardiovascular, and things like that. You know, that is being given some consideration. But to be testing some of these things and trying to understand, you know, what are the risks on the commercial flyer, you know, the space tourist. So I think that one has some applications, but it's a different application than the repeated flyer who would be a pilot, who I think the space company should be looking at. And then, of course, the other ones who are talking about, you know, like SpaceX going into deeper missions, I think that's a whole different human factors program, and absolutely they should be looking at these things, because from what we see on Earth, it makes a significant difference to personalize therapy, and in this case, countermeasures. We've seen it in the Corvette racing drivers already. So for the SpaceX types on the commercial side, I think that's going to be an imperative that either selection or tailoring to missions and the countermeasures tailored to each astronaut is probably going to be critical.
Okay, I have a couple of emails. Again, listeners, listen up. I cannot answer the toll-free line right now. So send in an email, and I'll try to fix it during the break if I can. But right now, I cannot do it. So you can call in until the cows come home, and I can't answer the line. Doug in Los Angeles, who's an MD, says, it seems to me that omics is opening up some new questions which haven't been asked before, for the space program, such as what is the correct dose of a medication for this specific astronaut? Is it possible that omics will cause us to be less certain that we are ready for a mission to Mars and so delay such a mission? I know that you said that omics would help answer questions, but might it at the same time create new questions which will give more reason to hesitate going to Mars? It is common for research to create more questions than it answers, hence requiring more and more research cost and time. And again, that's from Doug.
Yeah, thanks, Doug. Well, I share the thoughts. We've certainly looked at those thoughts. And so I think the answer is I would agree that the omics are going to create more questions than answers. I do think they will get us to certain questions more quickly than we would be going on a targeted basis. For example, the PGC-1 alpha that I talked about earlier was essentially arrived at through some omics-like work some years back. We may find new countermeasure targets from that. So I guess the question of will that delay us in spaceflight, this is only my opinion, of course. I think we set the missions based on the mission objectives that we have and that we go with what we know. And I wouldn't expect that omics should hold any of that up. And, of course, there's a whole lot of administrative decision-making and politics and things like that. But I think we all know those are risky operations. And just like in the military, there's a risk with an operation. We try to prepare them as best as possible, but we can't know everything. And I think if we wait to know everything, then we won't go. And so I think it's a fair juggling. I mean, it's a very fair question. I think it's a fair juggling of taking the risk, setting our timelines and our targets, and flying with what we know. Now, some people might disagree with that. They may say that's too much risk taking. But when we look at the kinds of risk, you know, ordinary people take on vacations, for example, and I know the implications of that aren't as serious as in a space program. I think there's a lot who would say that we shouldn't wait. You know, we won't ever know anything, so we should everything. So we probably should proceed, and then we'll have to make decisions of whether, in the omics world, if we've gathered enough information to make a certain choice. For example, you know, you mentioned the drug responses. One of the things that has gotten less attention than it probably should in space is because of the pretty dramatically different fluid dynamics in space related to Earth. You know, how are the drug metabolic profiles different in space versus Earth? Because they're likely to vary from drug to drug. So these perfusion issues do change drug dynamics, but we don't know exactly how in every case. So, you know, what do we do about the drugs in space issue? And I would argue that we should be genetically profiling every astronaut in terms of their drug metabolizing enzymes, and at least know that. So let's say you have someone who might need a, you know, let's say you have four astronauts flying. They might have a particular drug that's on the flight list, let's say acetaminophen, and you would look at, or an antibiotic for that matter. You would know, let's use 3A4 as an example, if they're cytochrome P450, you would know which one of those profiles each astronaut had, and you would say, well, this is not a factor for this astronaut. This one is a slow metabolizer, so we have to approach it accordingly. That's a fast metabolizer, so we might have to use a different drug. Or we might be giving a drug that blocks that enzyme, and we should know that person's susceptibility. So I think there are some areas that I think aerospace medicine would be able to agree on based on the science that we have. But I agree. I think we'll end up with more questions than answers from omics, and we'll have to live with that confusion and complexity.
We're never going to have all the answers, so you don't really advocate delaying then to get more answers, just on-the-job training.
Well, right. I mean, we're advocating using omics to accelerate our path to getting some of the answers. So, as I mentioned, we have a paper coming out on artificial gravity and use of omics to get to those answers quicker of what are the appropriate gravity parameters. So we would use all the usual physiologic metrics that we would normally use, heart, cognitive, blood flow, etc. But we believe that if you apply omics, you can find some off-target, unanticipated effects more quickly that may point us toward one gravity condition or another. And this has been somewhat done with transcriptomics already, showing different transcription of the genes at different gravity intensities. So we believe that will help get us some answers more quickly, or maybe disqualify certain G applications. So we think it will speed things up, potentially, but we have to find out.
Did anyone from Mars One ever contact you about this type of medicine and research?
We've had some communication, but it's not been extensive lately. We've had more regular communication with Inspiration Mars.
Okay, I'm going to do one more email from Christopher, and then we'll take a break, and I'll see if I can't fix the phone line or do a workaround with it. So Christopher's in Wyoming. What do you think of the notion of using deliberate hypothermia to store Mars-bound astronauts? Such measures can be used to drastically lower consumables use. Deliberate hyperthermia has been used to keep patients in stasis for long periods of time, to date weeks, including one severe spinal column fracture case who eventually recovered quite a bit of function.
Mm-hmm. That's a really interesting question, and I think hypothermia has been extremely useful. We and in some of our competitive work are definitely looking at core temperature. We're not. In some cases, we've experimented with pre-cooling, but not to the levels you're talking about by any means. But we're, you know, obviously recognizing the effect of temperature on physiologic changes, performance, decision-making, and things like that. So as a solution to a long mission, it's got some interesting possibilities. If I could add a thought to that, I think we have a ways to go with that in terms of understanding the full physiologic impact of healthy people over a mission parameter like that, but I think it's worth looking at. The one that we have been in favor of, trying to reduce the physical loads of a Mars mission and some of the potential genetic effects of extended radiation exposure, is some of the nuclear-powered craft that might go to Mars on an accelerated basis, perhaps take 3 months, thus limiting some of the exposures that you might get on the traditional Mars missions as they've been planned thus far. And one of the conceptions of this nuclear-powered craft is that it can also tumble and generate G-forces at its perimeter. In other words, the habitat's at one end, the nuclear engine's at another. The craft can shorten the trip to Mars to 3 months and also generate a G-force by its tumbling action. And that's got some interesting prospects. But, of course, all these designs, I think, are going to take a lot of discussion. And I think on the full physiologic cooling, I think it's very interesting, and I think we should investigate that.
Okay. Listeners, we're going to take a break, and it may be a little longer than 3 minutes because I'm going to see if I can't fix the toll-free phone line problem or do a quick workaround on it. So don't go anywhere, and we will be back. And thank you for your patience.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And listeners, welcome back. This is part two of our program today, and we are talking about Sunday. We're talking about personal spaceflight medicine with Dr. Michael Schmidt. So I have a call forward workaround on the toll-free line that should work, but no guarantees. So if you call the toll-free line, I should hear it ring rather than have lights flashing and be able to put you through to another line, which has a separate piece of equipment. So the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223, and I guess the first person to call it will be our test to see if my quick and dirty solution works for today's program. And in the meantime, lots of emails are coming in. Bijan in Sweden said, "How could sleeping in a small centrifuge help against microgravity, as some suggest? Mustn't the body stand up? What is the most important study which the space station should do?"
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, and I think At the last artificial gravity working group meeting, we recognized that it's been about 40 years of research in this area, but it hasn't gotten the kind of intense research maybe that we need to have for long-range missions, like a mission to Mars and so forth. So that, that question of which vector is critical, I don't think has fully been answered yet. In other words, sleeping versus being vertical. And I'll add another question of, if we look at the, if the force is being generated through the top of the head, then we have an issue of the radius, the length of the radius having an impact on the G-force. So, for example, with a short radius, you might have quite a different G-force at the feet versus the head. If you get to a long radius, they are more similar from head to toe. Some of these questions have not been fully answered, and that's what I think we need to do. So the question of G-forces being applied during sleep and then being in a microgravity environment during the working day, that has been proposed, and I would say we don't really know the answer to which of those is best right now, or for that matter, if we're sleeping in a G environment, how much is the adequate amount of time, and at what G-force must we be sleeping? And we don't know those answers, quite honestly.
His last question was, what would be the best experiment or the most important experiment to do on the ice, on the space station?
Yeah, in terms of gravity?
I guess so. That's the context of his question.
Yeah. Well, so, there has been a proposal to put a rotating wheel on the station. There's designs in existence. Cost was initially an issue, and then concerns about vibrations and things like that have been a part of that discussion. So some kind of rotating wheel type of centrifugation is the most common one thus far. The tumbling one I mentioned, which you couldn't of course do on a space station. The one that's possibly amenable to a space station is a human-powered centrifuge, which exists at NASA Ames. It exists basically right across the hall from the 20G centrifuge that most people probably saw in the movie Space Cowboys. That doesn't have the kind of space requirement, and it's been advocated both by NASA medical people and NASA engineers as one candidate. That may be the simplest and most pragmatic type of centrifugation to get on the station.
Let's see if the workaround for the toll-free line works. So, caller, are you with us?
Yes.
Okay.
Bill Rowe.
Okay, so this is Dr. Bill Rowe, Michael. So go ahead, Bill.
Dr. Smith, I have a couple of points that I wanted to make. Early, I was trying for about 20 minutes. I wasn't aware that the number wasn't working. It's related to pharmaceuticals that you mentioned in the beginning of the program. There are several problems with using any pharmaceuticals in microgravity. The problem is, and I've been working on it for 20 years, is the invariable potential for endothelial dysfunction in microgravity for multiple reasons, and with it, the potential for impairment in perfusion, both in the liver and the kidneys. So whatever pharmaceutical you use, there will be eventually, absolutely no question about it, impairment in the ability to metabolize or excrete whatever pharmaceutical you use. I can't say that it's going to happen in days or weeks or months, but eventually there is absolutely no question about it. It will occur. The other problem is that when writing about this, I looked this up, and there really aren't any subcutaneous pharmaceuticals. There is invariable malabsorption in microgravity, Amidon, all the way back in 1991 with very, very complicated formulas, equations, has shown that there is invariable malabsorption because nothing works in microgravity, including the gastrointestinal tract. So whatever is to to be given must be given subcutaneously, but you, for a long mission, you can't possibly poke someone every 6 or 8 hours for a mission of months and months, so that we need some type of replenishable subcutaneous device. But there is no, at this time, there is no replenishable subcutaneous device. In other words, something the size of a pocket watch that would be perhaps the size of a pacemaker, either in the abdomen or chest, and with multiple compartments with various pharmaceuticals, but they can be filled up with the manufacturing process. But once they're inserted, there's no way to replenish them. This is described by Santini and Langer back in Nature, the journal Nature, in 1999. So that's a problem that I don't know how to get around it. The other problem is that you mentioned that perhaps there is some substitute for exactly Earth-G, and I've been arguing for I guess 2 decades that I don't believe that any of the genes are going to, our genes are going to work unless we duplicate exactly Earth-G. So those are 2 points that I feel should be emphasized.
Well, yeah, and by the way, hello, Bill. Good to hear from you again.
Thank you.
And I think those are important points. And I to go back to the drug metabolism discussion. Yeah, there's an extensive amount of work I think that still needs to be done on that because for long missions we don't have some of those answers, and I think perfusion still is a considerable problem that we have to address. And then the question of G's, yeah, I would say we just don't know the appropriate G force. And you could strongly argue that it should be Earth analog. It should be 1G, and that even on, let's say we're on a Mars environment or a Moon environment, that we should focus on 1G and target it as such. And I think that's rational. I don't think we know the answer to these partial G or G applied for a portion of a day, for example, as was discussed with sleeping at G and then working at that microgravity. Some of those things we don't have very good answers for, and that's so one of our proposals, as I mentioned, was to look at some omics profiling of these different conditions. Obviously we have the normal physiologic profiles, but it's already been shown in some smaller varied G experiments that the transcription, for example, in a in one of the space station studies using a rotating wall vessel paradigm with human T cells, that those that were operating under the zero G conditions in space, these are T cells again, compared to those that were spun at 1G while in space, had significantly different expression patterns of genes related to TNF-alpha, NF-kappa-B, essentially regulating immune function. So those at zero G had a significantly reduced TNF-alpha expression, and essentially many of the genes related to the immune response were suppressed in zero G, and they recovered in an artificial G being applied in the zero G environment, of the microgravity environment. But that's just cells out of the context of the human body, but it gives us an idea that there are significant differences in critical parameters like immune function.
There is one more point. I don't know what the question was about sleep, but somebody from Sweden asked a question about sleep. But it's interesting that the average sleep duration in space is 6 hours. And everyone agrees that it should be at least, it used to be thought that it was 8 hours was necessary, but now it's down to about 7. But certainly less than 7 is conducive to oxidative stress. And the reason is that with sleep deprivation, there is an increase in the cytokines, and we already know that the cytokines are certainly increased in space. And with an increase in cytokines, there's an increase in oxidative stress, and this creates all sorts of problems. And what I'm concerned about, again, is impairment in perfusion because of increased oxidative stress. Well, anyhow, I enjoyed the conversation and listening to the show, and I'll listen to it again. Thanks, Dr. Schmidt.
Thanks so much, Bill. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you, Bill, for staying with us and calling in.
David, could I just add one thought to what Bill just said?
He's off the phone, but go ahead and add it.
Okay, yeah. So there's some studies that have been done in animals looking at sleep deprivation with a particular objective in mind. They ask the question, what happens to the gut in sleep deprivation in an earth environment? And they used various degrees of sleep deprivation and over a number of days, up to 20 days. And they found that there was a translocation of gut bacteria from the intestinal tract into the bloodstream in severe sleep deprivation, and that these microbes could be found in the lymph nodes and other organs at pretty high colony-forming units. Now, we don't exactly know if that happens in humans because it hasn't been tested to my knowledge, but it certainly raises the issue of the effects of persistent sleep deprivation, on GI mucosa integrity, and then the exposure to some of our own indigenous microbes over prolonged months and months of sleep deprivation. So it's something we should be alert to, and we should be investigating in these discussions of long-range missions.
Okay. Listeners, I do have a workaround in place for the toll-free line, so you can use it. 1-866-687-7223. Doug sent in another question. I submitted this question while Dr. Rowe was still on the phone and included in the subject that it was a question for Bill Rowe. Okay, sorry, I didn't see that. Please let me know how to get a question. My question to Dr. Rowe, and Bill, if you're still listening, you can answer this by email or you can call us back. Bill, previously a nutritionist on the space show, said that he could find very little difference between gut absorption on Earth and in space, but I hear you saying differently. Can you explain? And Michael, you might actually have evidence on that, at least with animals, right?
In terms of mucosal absorption of drugs or mucosal absorption of nutrients?
Since he's referencing a nutritionist that was on the space show a while back, I'm assuming he means nutrition. Bill is not with us, so I'm asking you the question. If Bill wants to call back in and respond, that's fine. He said that there was very little difference between gut absorption on Earth and in space. Would you concur with that or say that's an unknown question, or how would you respond to that?
Well, I guess the question I would have is, because I'm not familiar with the specific paper, different nutrients are absorbed through different mechanisms at different locations in the gut, which I'm sure he's quite familiar with. So I guess it's a question of dose and duration and which nutrients were tested, fat-soluble, water-soluble, at what point of the GI tract are they jejunal or ileal absorption? So I guess I would have a couple of questions about that. I think that in terms of the drugs, the drugs are foreign compounds. They have they go through what's called a BCS classification system that has to do with their solubility and permeability. So there's some drugs that are highly soluble and highly permeable, meaning that they dissolve well in the fluids of the body, and then they cross the membranes well, they're absorbed well. But other drugs are poorly soluble and poorly permeable, for example. They have characteristics that make them difficult to absorb anyway. And I think one of the points is that each drug is unique in its absorption profile, and we don't know how all of the different drugs are absorbed in space because we haven't tested them all in space. I would say there's also been some tests on drugs in space where stability has come into question of some of them. So that would probably be the extent of my answer on that one.
Okay.
I'd love to st- studies, though.
Okay, and again, Bill, if you're listening and you want to respond, please feel free to call back or send in an email. And sometimes I'm being the only one here. I don't see emails directed to a caller. So it's not a good way to communicate to a caller. Sometimes I get busy. Doug has another question. How do non-onomics interventions relate to onomics? For example, NASA data indicates that 50 G over centimeter squared shielding reduces the GCR radiation by about two-thirds and nearly all the radiation exposure from the sun. So if we have such countermeasures, does this make onomics as necessary or vice versa?
Well, I think omics helps us to understand some of the minor off-target effects. So, for example, we might be looking at a particular, let's say, a chromosomal damage or nuclear buds or nuclear bridges. You know, we have a whole range of indicators of DNA damage, or we might look at DNA repair enzymes like PARP, base excision repair enzymes, and, you know, I'll just kind of stop there with the long names, but one of the things that omics can help to do is identify whether there are more subtle effects happening earlier or that take longer to manifest as more pathological effects. These would be more functional or more subtle. It's what's being done in drug studies right now to use omics to identify off-target effects. So for studying one drug versus another, you might look at the primary liver and kidney enzymes and all kinds of tissues as your prime measure and compare the two drugs. But there may be more subtle effects that are showing on pathways you're not looking at, and that's where omics can be helpful. So I think omics can still be helpful in those kinds of environments. And as I was saying earlier, and from one of our earlier NASA and suborbital presentations, you know, we talk about things like one-carbon metabolism affecting DNA stability before going into the space environment. But I think this is critical. There's a range of things that can affect DNA stability and repair. So you could be flying with unstable DNA or diminished repair capability, and then you enter a radiation environment that's thought to be safer, but your susceptibility is increased because of your particular genetic profile, micronutrient profile, etc. So I think there's still a value there and an application there, if I understood the question properly.
Paul is in Cleveland, and he says, can any of these studies be done with bed rest studies?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think that we've learned a lot from bed rest studies before, and I mentioned an example of PGC1-alpha that affects mitochondria in all tissues, but certainly muscle. I think we can do some of them. I think we really have to focus though as much as we can on getting into space and now doing some of these studies. For example, our G studies on Earth, we can't very easily get a zero-G environment here to then add the different G conditions. So if we're going to try and understand what's the artificial gravity application, I think we need to get in space for that, for example, where we have microgravity, and then we can apply 0.5G, 0.75G, 1.0G at different time courses with different parameters to get to that. So I think we can still learn some things a lot from bed rest, but in terms of what's the artificial gravity application, I think we need to be approaching as fast as we can getting into space to test some of those. But I wanted to, David, to backtrack just a moment to the shielding question.
Okay.
Because I think it takes us into the protecting the brain and the brain-derived neurotrophic factor discussion, which might be a good segue to jump into. So Tom Goodwin and I presented at the recent NASA Human Research Program Integrated Pathway to Mars meeting in January 2015. That was in Galveston. And we focused on, if we're going to look at protecting neural structures and preserving cognitive function on space missions, we should look at one particular network, which is called the brain-derived neurotrophic molecular network, or brain-derived neurotrophic factor molecular network. Brain-derived neurotrophic factor is a protein that is made in the brain. It's produced by the signal that comes from the BDNF gene. That's the primary activity-dependent neurotrophin in the human brain. So if you want to generate new stem cells in the hippocampus, if you want to preserve or expand neural networks, if there's damage or injury and you have to repair it, all of those things, you need brain-derived neurotrophic factor. And so it's a very interesting target because there's mutations in those genes that affect the ability to repair in the brain. There's the epigenome effects that affect the ability to repair. There's these post-translational, or the protein itself gets changed after the fact, which affect how repair takes place in the brain. And one of the reasons I wanted to raise that in relation to the other question about shielding was that the hippocampus produces, this is the key memory center in the brain that has the primary stem cell population. So most of the brain doesn't have ordinary stem cells, but the hippocampus does. It produces about 700 new stem cells per day. Those give rise to new neurons, which affect formation of new memories, etc. So this BDNF affects that. Well, we know that the hippocampus is more sensitive to radiation than a lot of other tissues, and thus the brain is more sensitive. So the millisievert doses that are acceptable for the hippocampus are set lower because of that vulnerability. So when we're looking at shielding, or when we're looking at unshielded but duration of exposure, we want to really focus on this brain-derived neurotrophic factor network because it governs all of the neuronal repair in the brain and the new stem cell genesis and things of that nature. So to give you an example of how we can use that for countermeasures and things, we know with lack of exercise or with immobility, and this kind of go back to the bed rest study, you can get a significant reduction in BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. So the ability to repair, generate new neurons and repair existing neural networks and expand them can be impaired just by immobility. So let's think about the space station. The space station has a pretty good exercise platform right now. But when we look at the volumes that a Mars craft will have, you know, we're not likely to have the same exercise capabilities there. But if we're looking at preserving brain function through these neural networks, exercise is going to be quite critical to maintain that capability. In some of the animal studies where they've exposed them to radiation and then looked at brain-derived neurotrophic factor, the effects on BDNF are pretty dramatic. When they expose animals who have been exercising, they can preserve some of their BDNF. So we know that even in a radiation environment, an experimental one, that exercise can help restore or maintain at least some of the BDNF. We know there's certain components in the diet that appear to restore and maintain that activity. There are some drugs that appear to maintain that activity. So this would be along the lines of getting back to our personalized medicine discussion. There's a profile for BDNF. There's a gene mutation that affects cognition. It affects development of neurodegenerative diseases. There's things in the epigenome that can slow or impair the expression of that gene. Then there's these things that affect the protein and so forth. So this would be an example of the kind of gene network and molecular network we would look at for a personalized countermeasure package. And especially if we're looking at long-range missions with long-range radiation exposures, even in a shielded environment, we'd still want to understand, okay, we may have protected peripheral and some central body components, but what about brain and what about the most sensitive areas of brain?
Can I take the abstract you sent me and post it on the Space Show blog?
Yeah.
So that's okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Is that paper available publicly, or is it not available yet?
Well, so that abstract was presented at NASA in January, and that was published on NASA's website of the presentations for that. So, but the full paper we haven't published yet. That's in development.
Okay, so I will put the abstract up on the blog, and that's kind of a short summary of what you've just been talking about, correct?
Yeah.
Going back to what you said earlier in the segment, and then I want to return to this newer topic. Christopher had an email for you. Maybe a cheaper alternative to putting a wheel on the ISS would be to send up a Bigelow HAB with a power module last stage. Put the power module last stage and the HAB on opposite ends of a long tether. Send up a Dragon capsule with volunteers to dock on the opposite end of the HAB and spin the mess up with attitude rockets. Spin it back down when the experiment ends. Separate the capsule and return. Any thoughts on something like that?
Well, that's definitely an engineering question that probably comes from an engineer. I think that's an interesting concept. And I think somehow we have to try to generate, like you were suggesting, those kinds of forces in a microgravity environment so that we really can understand these effects over time. As far as the actual engineering, I would leave that to the engineers. I know that in our artificial gravity working group meetings, we've had engineers discussing variations and then expressing concerns about vibration to the station as a whole. But all of those things seem to be the sorts of things that can be resolved with proper engineering. But again, that part is not my field, but it seems to have possibilities and certain complexities that I think engineers have talked about being able to resolve.
Going back to what you were talking about with BDNF a few minutes ago, is there any research that has come out of the Russian program or our program? Do we know if astronauts are having cognitive function impairing or on some of the longer voyages with cosmonauts, were they cognitively deprived in some sense? Is this problem translating into a real-time problem for people in space?
Well, there's certain, I don't know about the Russian literature per se. I'm aware of certain cases that have been shared in confidence of significant breakdowns in the Russians, not in the Russians in general, I mean cases on the long duration mirror and things like that, that have been more mood than cognitive, but obviously those two things couple. There's in the, you probably are familiar with the Mars simulation mission that was done in Russia recently, where you could argue that only two of the subjects on that long simulation fared extremely well out of the six. There were significant cognitive and mood changes, and a lot of that has to do with isolation. And I think that what we, when we talk about space, we often talk about oxygen and free radicals and radiation and so forth. But the one thing that we can't really understand right now is, the space station is pretty close to Earth, and you can see it. It's still quite big, and even at the level of the Moon, the Earth is still present. But we don't really know how someone will react when they get 300 days away from Earth, and it's not visible in the way they're accustomed to, and they know that it's 300 days away. We have no real great analog to study that. Even when we study isolation in Earth, the subjects or the participants still know they're on Earth. So they have their significant isolating effects. But what will happen at a cognitive and a mood level from the isolation of being that far from Earth. That's going to be something we'll have to wait for a Mars mission to really understand.
I'm not sure if I mentioned on the earlier show to you Professor Vadim Rigoloff at the Space Studies Department at the University of North Dakota. Did I mention
him?
Okay, so Vadim came over from the Soviet Union, and he is a life science biologist, space guy, radiation, all of it. And he's become a very good friend of mine over the years because I also do teaching at UND, and we just hit it off. And his early space show programs, he talked about his role in keeping Mir cosmonauts level-minded, which was really hard to do. And he talked about after 4 months, they started separating from Earth, and it became increasingly difficult to control the crew. He talked about the conditions that they set up to try to keep them in touch and not disassociate from Earth. And this is when they could still see Earth. This is not like going to Mars when you're not going to be able to see Earth or recognize it. And he talked about some of the difficulties and challenges they had and what they had to do to mentally, psychologically hold the crew together and keep them functioning. And at times they didn't. There was even a mutiny attempt. There was a fist fight. There were other problems that happened. And Vadim was one of the people that held those crews together. And he said that he could talk about it because it was declassified on the Russian side, a lot of it about what they did. And I think maybe the first two or three space show programs that Vadim did early on, he documented a lot of what he did to keep Mir crews from going bonkers and what they learned in that process. And he did say the disassociation from Earth, the inability to communicate with people back home. All of this weighed heavily into not only mood, but their cognitive ability to function, and that they counter that a lot now. I mean, you know, they have email, they have different levels of communications on the space station. You know, there's all sorts of different tools that they didn't have on those early days of Mir, you know, when this was going on. But he would be a really interesting guy for you to talk to.
Yeah.
Because he was one of the people that held Mir crews together on those longer missions.
Well, I'd like that, because some of the information I've gotten has been, you know, through the Russian space program, but through colleagues who worked on a day-to-day basis with some of those crews. So that would be very interesting.
Yeah, and listeners, if you go back through the archives and look up Vadim, V-A-D-I-M, Rigoloff, I think it's R-Y-G-A-L-O-V, his earlier shows, I think there was maybe 2 to 4 earlier shows where he talks about this problem extensively. It's worth noting, and it kind of fits with what you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, let me add one thought, David, because I know we're getting close to the end here. And this goes back to why personalized medicine, why these genotyping is so important and these molecular networks. And this is an Earth-based study, and we would have to do more work to clarify this. But there's a study done at McGill that looked at humans with what's called a VAL66 MET mutation. Valine is replaced by methionine. It's a particular gene mutation that's quite common, even more common in Asians. And they tested different populations. They've done parallel studies with mice and humans in a stress condition, and I'll just focus on the humans because of time. In the humans with the mutation, when they were under a stress condition, the part of the brain that lit up under MRI, functional MRI, under the stress condition, was the amygdala, while the prefrontal cortex was somewhat downregulated. The amygdala is really the fear center of the human brain, and it is often activated under stress conditions, but you don't want it to be activated in advance of the prefrontal cortex in ordinary situations. Those with the normal genetic profile under the stress condition had an activation of the prefrontal cortex first and a lower activation of the amygdala, meaning their fear center was not activated first. So what it really suggests, and again, these would have to be replicated, but if they carry over into an astronaut population, and if we really understand that that's a pattern, it might suggest that, you know, this genotype, the VAL66MEP genotype, might be more susceptible to a more severe fear response under a prolonged stress condition like a deep space mission. And that in that case, you'd want to either look at a countermeasure or you'd want to look at using that as a selection for people on such missions. Now, I'm not saying that we're there yet on that particular genotype because some of the research is conflicting depending upon the context. But some of the research is quite suggestive as well. So that's the sort of thing that we want to be continually discussing and exploring as we look at susceptibilities or what are the right types of countermeasures. And as we get further away, looking at more of the psychological, psychosocial, and cognitive-related genetic markers that we can then start to target for selection or target for countermeasures, but at least start to understand better as we kind of go into these high-risk, long environments.
You have one more question. You have time for it?
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. Comes from Doug again, he says if anyone out there who has an answer, he'd be happy to hear it. You guys can post an answer on the blog if you can give him an answer as well. When using shielding on a mission to Mars, it preferentially stops the lower energy GCR, so it may be that one-third of the GCR energy gets through, but perhaps 90% of all the GCRs are stopped. So relatively few GCRs get through, but they tend to be higher in energy in terms of the number of brain cells killed. Do you think that it is a number or the energies of GCRs that ultimately matters?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I know Charlie Limley has done some work on this specifically in looking at dendritic branching. And he may be the one to have an answer on that. I'm not sure that I do. One of the things we're trying to understand, again, is some of these genes like BDNF, do they have greater or lesser susceptibility to those different types of conditions? And can they be modified so that the susceptibility is improved? Charlie might be someone who could answer a question like that, or maybe in his papers.
What is his name again?
Charles Limley.
How do you spell his last name?
Limoli.
I wonder if he'd be a guest on the space show.
Possibly, yeah. I think he's at UC Irvine.
Is he a nice guy?
Yeah, yeah, he's a good guy.
Can I use your name if I contact him?
Sure, yeah. You could say, you know, either me or Tom Goodwin or both. Yeah.
Okay. I'll see if I can find him on the faculty and send him an invite.
Yeah, in fact, Charles just had a paper published dealing with space radiation in Mars and brain.
Okay. Any particular closing comments or anything that we should have talked about or haven't or that you wanted to tell us?
Well, yeah, I think just basically to put this personalized medicine back in context, I mean, personalized medicine is really here to stay in Earth-based medicine. Space-based medicine has been slower to adapt the concept, but some of the main impediments to personalized medicine as a global approach on Earth is just simply cost, because, you know, it often requires a bit more extensive testing to properly profile an individual. But on a mission like this, you know, cost is not really the issue. You know, we're spending tremendous amounts generating other aspects of the mission. So we think that the benefits you could gain from those costs are squarely in favor of the benefits. And in fact, that space might be the optimum environment in which to deploy personalized medicine. And you know, certainly how we approach the Corvette racing drivers. And just as a note there, you know, we have found genetic profiles in those small number of drivers. Only six on a Corvette team, two cars, but we have found markers that have led to particular countermeasures that have led to improvements. So you know, we think that space is the ripe environment. And if we look at it from the standpoint of what can we deploy today, what can we deploy in the near term, and then how do we establish a program for long-term development of a personalized medicine program, I think that's really the way to approach it. So we have some answers now. We expect to have more in the near term, and then some will take time. But I think it's here to really stay, and we expect it will be how medicine in space is done for the foreseeable future.
Is it being taught in medical schools?
Personalized medicine?
Yes.
Itself?
Yes.
Well, it is in probably, depending upon how you characterize it, probably 30 or 40 medical schools. But if you look at just the genetic components of cancer, that's being explored more widely because it's more straightforward. But if you look at things like hemochromatosis, one carbon metabolism, some of the other things, that's being taught in all the medical schools. And that's why we're so confident that these early things can be deployed right away.
I think I may have mentioned, listeners know, my younger son has cystic fibrosis, and it's being used extensively in all the new research and drugs for CF.
Yes.
Big
absolutely.
Time. And the companies that are doing it, and when they come out with a product, are making millions and millions of dollars. Vertex is one of them, with their targeted drugs to specific gene mutations. And unbelievable prices on their stock every time they make an announcement.
Yes, and the whole RNAi world is built around that concept, and it really is going to change medicine. And as far as space medicine, we think it's the way that it will be done. There will be no going back to the old way eventually.
Well, I will look forward to following this up with you and Tom down the road, because I know you'll stay with it and keep me posted, and I appreciate your coming back to give us this update.
Yeah, thanks so much, David. Really appreciate it. Take care.
Thank you, and until the next time. Listeners, that's it for today, and look at the newsletters for what's going on this week. And thank you all for being with us today, and thanks to our good Dr. Michael Schmidt for being with us as well. And sorry for the toll-free line problem. We do have to get that fixed, but at least we have a doable workaround for programs until we do get it fixed. Thank you all again for listening and participating in today's Space Show program. Goodbye from the Space Show.